Joe Biden has been a United States Senator from Delaware since 1973. Over that time, he's observed presidents Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Clinton, and two Bushes. But now he's running for president and promises to keep on life and politics, which is published by Random House. Senator Biden recounts the personal tragedies and political victories he's experienced in office. We will talk about that and also why he thinks he should be president and what he would do about Iraq. I'm very pleased to welcome Joe Biden to the show. Hello.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's become common for presidential candidates to write memoirs that reveal parts of their character that the public may be unaware of. What do you think this book reveals about you that we haven't seen yet?
Well, I don't know that it reveals really anything that hasn't been seen or talked about over my career. I got elected when I was 29. I've been there for a while. There are still 43 or 44 senators older than me, so I've been hanging around a while, but with a lot of new people as well.
But you've been in the public spotlight for a long time, and anything you do has been scrutinized.
Yeah, and I think everything I write about in the book is there's nothing revealing in the sense that people didn't know it, but it's amazing. You know, one of the things you've got to realize in my business is that, my grandpa would say, Patty's a 9 days wonder. I mean, if you're not in the race, then, you're easily, people don't know much about you. A lot of the reporters who covered me 20 years ago aren't covering anybody, politics anymore. And so it sort of starts from scratch. And when I agreed to write this book, it was a fellow named Richard Ben Kramer who wrote What It Takes. And Richard started on me in the early 90s, trying to get me to write a book. He wanted me to write a book about, how my personal values and my experience have informed my public policy. And so in 2004, quite frankly, when I thought John Kerry was going to be president, I agreed with Random House to write this book and never thinking I was going to be running for president. So I'm not sure the book fits very well with running for president one way or another.
Well, what do you think has been the public perception of you since your announcement to run for president? Well, and I'd like you to be brutally honest.
Well, I think the perception is, as one of my pollsters told me, is that I am a guy who was the Secretary of State, born behind a podium, probably went to Yale University and comes from a wealthy family, which is the furthest thing from who I am. But when you think about it, I have been, according to the press, I've been on more of the talking head shows, the serious Sunday shows and the like in the last 6 years than anybody else. And every time anybody's heard anything from me, in the last 4 or 5 years, it's been on a single issue because I've not done any political shows until I decided to run. I've not done any political dinners in 20 years. I've not gone out and done the Democratic dinner in the state of California kind of thing. Not that there's anything wrong with those. I just decided not to do it because I wanted to focus on what I was doing. But the fact is, I don't think many people will remember that I was chairman of the Judiciary Committee or ranking member for 17 years. I presided over the Bork hearing, that I presided over the Thomas hearing.
You don't think people will remember that? They watch you on television.
I think when it's recalled to them, they will. But don't hold me to this number. But my understanding is, in terms of the number of people in America who recognize my name, it's more than half. But those who think they know enough about me to make a judgment about me is more like 20%. So I think we in politics, we have an inflated view of what we think pay attention to.
Well, you mentioned that a lot of people think of you as Secretary of State, and you're often included in a list of potential U.S. Secretaries of State. Is that something that you welcome at all?
No. If I wanted to be Secretary of State, I surely wouldn't be running against the very people who would be the ones that are likely to appoint the Secretary of State. I'm running for president because I think that that I am not uniquely, but best suited right now, based on my career, my background, my experience, my track record, to deal with the most important problems facing the country now, which happen to fall in the category of national security, terrorism, and issues that affect the middle class at home here.
When you announced your candidacy for the Senate in 1972, you said, I'm running for the Senate because I want to make the system work again. Well, yep. It's 35 years later, and I'd guess that most Americans believe that the system still doesn't work. And I wonder why you think that is.
Well,
I know you couldn't have done it alone.
No. I think it's a fair question. But I think if you look at it, it runs in ebbs and flows. From 1972, when I ran, when no one had any faith in government, we went through a period for the next 12 to 14 years where people gained confidence in the government. Things began to change. A lot of good things did happen. The world changed for the better in the most part. We saw Latin America become democratic. We saw the Soviet Union fall. We saw some serious changes. I wrote a crime bill to put 100,000 cops in the street that brought down violent crime 8 years in a row. We wrote the Violence Against Women Act. But what happens in American history, like all history, is it tends to repeat itself. And what happened is we sort of ditched our ideals and our values, took on a new ideological philosophy. We began to dig ourselves into a deep hole, and we have to dig it back out. This is a constant fight. The reference I use sometimes, it's like cutting grass. You cut your grass this weekend, it looks great. You don't cut it for another 6 months, it looks terrible.
Well, when you made that rather brash promise for a political neophyte, you were a county council member.
I was.
And you went from county council member to running for the Senate at the age of 29?
Yes, I did. And it was purely accidental. I had no intention of running for the United States Senate. I came back from law school at Syracuse University in 1968 after Dr. King had been assassinated. And my city was in flames. My city, the city of Wilmington, was one of those cities that was major parts of were burned to the ground in riots. And I joined a group in my state to, quote, reform the Democratic Party. Most people think of the Delaware being an eastern or a northeastern state. It really is more it's a border state. Two-thirds of my state considered itself south.
It's like Maryland.
And it was, we're part of the Delmarva, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia Peninsula.
Where
and
the so, chickens come from.
That's exactly right. $3 billion industry in that area. And so I guess the point I'm trying to make is that I came back and joined a group of reformers to try to bring the Democratic Party in line with the National Democratic Party as opposed to the Southern Democratic Party. And one thing led to another. No one would run against a very popular incumbent United States senator. I was appointed to a committee to help find someone, and the bottom line was the senior guy said, you do it. And so I did it, and I won by a landslide of about 3,000 votes.
My guest is Joe Biden. He's written a memoir called Promises to Keep on Life and Politics, published by Random House. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you've been there for 35 years. I'm sure you never imagined when you were 29 that's what you'd be doing. How have relationships between senators on opposite sides of the aisle changed in those 35
Leonard,
years?
Leonard, they've changed drastically. When I first got to the Senate, I had no intention of staying in the Senate. I got elected in November the 3rd, and November the 20th, I became old enough constitutionally. And November 18th, I lost my family or a big chunk of it in an automobile accident.
Some people would have dropped out of politics. It was just at the beginning of your career.
Well, I did. I announced that I was going to drop out of politics to my governor to appoint someone else. And there were great guys back then, both sides of the aisle, guys like Senator Mike Mansfield, people like a guy named Saxby, who was from the state of Ohio, Ted Kennedy, people who embraced me and convinced me to stay for, quote, 6 months. Then I could leave, help them organize. And little did I know that what they were doing for me probably, at least in an emotional sense, saved my life. I was raising my two boys. I started commuting. I've never lived in Washington since then. I never lived in Washington, period. And what happened was one thing led to another. But back in those days, when I first got there, there were some really interesting old guys who I had strong disagreement with. Southerners, the Southern Democrats, James O. Eastland, John Stennis, Herman Talmadge, all these guys. But the difference between then and now was we questioned each other's judgment, but motive was not questioned. Today, if you disagree with some, you are immoral. You are not a good Christian. You are not patriotic. I mean, it's
Was it that way during the McCarthy era?
It was, but I wasn't there then. So I think, again, it's the ebb and flow of American politics. I think it was that way from what I read in the late 40s and through the 50s, but in the late in the early 70s through the 80s, it wasn't that way.
Partly because the Democrats pretty much controlled Congress for much of that time.
Well, I think that's true. And I think what happened was...
Seniority is a key thing, controlling all of the committee chairmanships.
Well, I'll tell you a story. When I first got there, Mike Mansfield, who was the majority leader, a guy who most people would tell you had more integrity in his little finger than most people have in their whole body, used to have me come to his office once a week and give me an assignment. Looking back on it, he was basically taking my pulse after losing my wife and daughter to see if I was really focused. And I remember one day walking into his office for my 3 o'clock appointment. He said, "How's it going?" And I just come off the floor of the Senate. And I said, "You know," I said, "I don't understand this." I said, "Here you got this guy Jesse Helms out there railing against the Americans with Disability Act. How could anybody be that?" I started to question his motive. And Mansfield just looked at me, took the pipe out of his mouth. He said, "What would you say, Joe, if I told you Jesse and Dot Helms, his wife, several years ago on the eve of Christmas, adopted a child who was wheelchair-bound in braces?" And I said, "Oh, my God, I'd feel awful." He said, "Well, that's exactly what they did." And he said, "Joe, don't question the motives of your opponents. Question their judgment."
There's been a lot of more turnover in the Senate over the last 20 years. Do you think that affects the ability to create bipartisan relationships?
Well, I think what's affected, I think that has some of it. But I think the other part of it is there's an awful lot of people beginning in 94 coming from the House of Representatives. And that's not a bad thing, except it's a very different ethic over there. And the system was designed to work differently than the Senate is designed to work. And it has always been more partisan. And quite frankly, the point you made earlier, the Democrats did not treat the Republicans very well in the House during that period of roughly 50 years they were in control. And when the House Republicans who got elected in the Gingrich Revolution came over, they were angry. John McCain used to refer to them as the Khmer Rouge. It became a lot more personal. And today, the ideological bent has become an impediment for people working together. It really is. People actually will get criticized if they work too closely with the other side, which is a big, big problem.
Does the seniority that you have and the fact that you're prominent on the national stage allow you to get more things done for your home state of Delaware?
Well, it does, Delaware is not very big on, doesn't have much of a tradition on, getting money for Lawrence Welk Museum kind of things. It helps Delaware because we're such a small state and have such a small constituent, a small congressional delegation. Having two senators, one of whom is very senior, allows us to at least get in the mix to get our fair share of needed bridge money, for example.
Well, that is always something that people are concerned about, people outside of Congress. Is it possible to remain in office for 35 years without having to sometimes place the interest of the people of your home state above those of the American people?
Oh, I think it is. I mean, for example, I have done that a number of times and been rewarded for it by my constituents. For example, in the early 70s, I'm the guy that was asked, I was on a committee now called the Environment Committee, and I was asked to write a report about whether or not we should keep letting gasoline, phase it out, or eliminate it. And I wrote a report saying eliminate lead and gasoline, but the DuPont company had a patent on a thing called a lead trap. Had I written a report saying, no, you can have lead and gasoline, you just have to retrofit the exhaust pipe, it would have been $1 billion to the DuPont company. It was against my interest of my state, but it was in the interest of the country, and no one in my state punished me for that.
Do senators from the bigger states like California, Texas, and New York have to spend more or less time on national affairs or on bringing home the bacon to their
homes? I think it kind of depends on how they are viewed by their colleagues. And I know that seems non-responsive. But what happens in the Senate, your influence is in direct proportion to your ability to master a subject that gains the respect of your colleagues. For example, not talk about myself. Let's take Bill Bradley. Bill Bradley and I are very close friends when he was in the Senate. There wasn't an issue relating to international finance. There wasn't an issue relating to the monetary system, all those kinds of issues. I didn't go speak to Bill. I'm an informed guy. I think I'm pretty smart, but I know Bill knew a great deal about it. So if you want to have an impact in the Senate, the way you have an impact is you decide either to be the guy who is going to be the ombudsman for your state. Remember, they used to kid Al D'Amato, Senator Pothole. Well, he did a great job for his state. But there was another senator at the same time, a good friend of mine, Pat Moynihan. And Pat Moynihan was able to survive in a big state by being a guy who was a man of big ideas and mastered other subjects. So it kind of depends on the route you choose to take.
You mentioned earlier that many people forget that you were the chairman of the Senate Committee on the Judiciary from 1987 to 1995 and presided over both the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas. I wonder about how you were able to defeat the nomination of Bork but not Thomas, who had been accused of sexual indiscretions. Many people actually remain angry with you for not coming to Anita Hill's defense.
Well, I did come to... Well, let's take them one at a time. Bork, we were able to defeat because Bork was honest about his positions. We had a straight-up ideological debate, and he was straightforward, and I was convinced that if we had that debate, the American public was not prepared to go backwards on the expansion of individual rights, which he believed did not exist in the Constitution if they were not enumerated or stated. And that was a close fight in the committee, but it was Bork was straightforward, answered the questions, and it was a contest about where America wanted to go. With regard to the Clarence Thomas hearing, what people forget is we had a vote before Anita Hill even came around, before we knew about Anita Hill, and it was a 7-7 tie, which means he did not have technically enough votes to get out of the committee. But then when the Anita Hill thing broke, it became such a spectacle. One of the things that people talked about then was I did believe Anita Hill, and I did state that I believed Anita Hill. But one of the problems was that it became such a personalized battle and it became almost like a gigantic soap opera. I was told that over 150 million people worldwide watched that portion of the hearing. And what it implicated was, and why I believed it would, I said so before we got into it, it was about a major, major hidden issue in American society about harassment of women, which I had been on the forefront of trying to expose with the Violence Against Women Act and other things.
Clarence Thomas made it into a racial thing.
Yeah, and he did. And so that's the point. You just stated the point. It became viewed as, on the one side, if you're against me, it's because I'm an African-American man. And on the other side, if you're for Anita Hill, it's because you are just a feminist who's concerned about whatever. And it got
Except
very
Anita Hill was also an African-American.
Yes.
That should have eliminated.
Well,
the
it
whole
should
racial
have, but you watched it. You watched it unfold, and it didn't. And I thought the attacks on her were unfounded, but it got confusing, as you know. What people wanted me to do, some of the groups that were very upset with me, is that I wouldn't use the same tactics against him that were being used against her. But it seems to me that one of the things I feel very strongly about is process is as important as substance. I mean, process is what protects us all. And I remember one group coming to me and saying that, why don't you point out that he has watched pornography? You could go get his records. It's illegal to get his records from the video store. And my response was that, what would you say if I said to you, I'm the guy that wrote the Rape Shield Law, it's like saying, well, you know, go find out whether or not she had sex before. I said, look, there's a principle engaged here. And that got me in some real trouble for treating the hearing as if you needed evidentiary standards. Admittedly, you don't need them, but it seems to me there was a need to inject some standard in it. And at the end of the day, a bare majority of my colleagues stayed with President Bush and gave him his nominee. I strongly opposed it, and I think we were right to oppose him because I don't think he's been a very a judge who said he'd do what he would do.
Well, many people have claimed that the Robert Bork confirmation hearings actually was an important lesson for conservatives, because from that point on, people did not admit to their politics. They said, well, I will reserve judgment until the case comes before me.
And that's absolutely true.
Pretty much they have decided pretty much
exactly
based
right.
on what everybody assumed they would decide it on.
I think you're correct. That's why I wrote a major piece some years ago saying how I would change the confirmation process. That's why I was so strongly opposed Roberts and so strongly opposed Alito. I don't believe they were being straightforward with us. And I think their rulings demonstrate that it's inconsistent with what they led people to believe their philosophy was.
My guest is Joe Biden. He's written a memoir called Promises to Keep on life and politics. It's published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after this. We're talking with Joe Biden, who was elected to the Senate in 1972 when he was just 29 and immediately was faced with a terrible tragedy because of a car accident in which two sons, Beau and Hunt, were hurt but survived, but his wife, Nelia, and baby daughter, Naomi, died. And then, here we are 35 years later, and two presidential campaigns later, talking about his career, his memoir called Promises to Keep on Life and Politics, published by Random House. You ran for president in 1988. How has the process of campaigning changed since then?
Well, it's changed a great deal. The amount of money allegedly needed to be able to compete is staggering. Candidates are talking about the need to raise $100 million in the primaries. The second thing that's changed is that when I ran last time, in the early states in which you campaign, like Iowa, they had lost confidence in themselves because their states were in trouble, but they still had confidence in the country. Today, I find it the opposite. The states have some confidence in what's going on in their home states, but they're very concerned about our place in the world, what's going on in the country. I've never seen the American public as focused. I've seen them angrier. I've seen them more upset. But they are focused on the big ticket items. For example, I would be asked in the first five questions in someone's living room in Iowa or New Hampshire 22 years ago, I'd be asked about social issues. Almost without fail, every question now is about foreign policy, Iraq, or about health care. So they're really focused on major, major issues.
Although you did come to Congress at a time when we were still involved with the
yes.
Vietnam War.
Yeah, no, I came running against the Vietnam War. But at that point, by 72, all they wanted to know when you were running is, are you for it or against it? They had already made up their mind. They want to know where you were. Today, there is a sense when during Vietnam, and we're comparable ages, during Vietnam, whether you were for the war, against it, went, didn't go, the consensus was if we got out of there, we'd be able, there were no more shoes to drop, that we could attend to business at home. But nobody believes, in my view, that if we ended the war in Iraq tomorrow, we're safe in the world. No one believes if we ended the war tomorrow that we have a policy that has any prospect of settling things in the Middle East or the Korean Peninsula, et cetera. So it's a very different attitude about what happens even if we end this war.
Washington Post columnist Richard Cohn has said that your manic obsessive running of the mouth could be the character weakness that disqualifies you from competing with the front runners. And the other night, Hillary Clinton in the AFL-CIO debate said, though, that though she was, I assume, talking about Barack Obama, it's not good to always say what's on your mind when you run for president. So how do you respond to that?
As I called Richard when he wrote that article about a year ago, and I said, Richard, we'll find out. I consider him a friend and an honest reporter. We'll find out whether you're right. The public will make that judgment. If you notice in those debates, I'm the only one that keeps within my time. and I think I can't speak for Senator Clinton. I think you should say what you believe, but you don't always have to. Whatever you say should be what you believe. But you shouldn't say all the time what you believe about everything. And the point she was making was, if you were president of the United States, you surely would not publicly state ahead of time you're prepared to disregard the sovereignty of another country. You may have to do it, but do it. Don't talk about it.
Well, according to the USA Today Gallup poll that was released earlier this week, Hillary Clinton is at 48%, Barack Obama at 26%, Edwards at 12%, you and Richardson at 3%, and the model didn't include Al Gore. As the Democratic presidential race increasingly becomes a contest between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and to a lesser degree, John Edwards, what do you think differentiates you from the front runners?
Well, I don't think it will be that. You know, let me remind you, the same polls, same time, at this point, last campaign, had Howard Dean the nominee. He had $50 million in the bank. He was a presumptive nominee. Our nominee, who ended up being the nominee, was number 6 and 5 in the polls in Iowa, New Hampshire, and nationally.
So you can only hope that Hillary screams or
no,
something.
No, not at all. It doesn't matter. Nobody's made up their mind. Nobody. The polls, if you underneath those polls, every pollster will tell you fewer than 10% of the American people have made their mind. Right now, this is about celebrity. This is about name recognition. And the same poll that showed Hillary with 48% of the vote showed that 49% of the people had a negative opinion about her. So the idea of what's going to end up being a major, major issue, I predict, in this election for Democrats is electability. Who can go out and win in those red states? Who can go out and win Missouri and Louisiana and Kentucky and Virginia and those places? And the question will be raised whether or not the better-known candidates now can or cannot. It's for the public to decide, but it will become a major issue.
In the AFL-CIO debate earlier this week, both you and John Edwards described your long commitment to labor. But yesterday, the AFL-CIO announced it wouldn't endorse a Democratic candidate. How does that decision affect your campaign?
Well, it affects my campaign positively in the sense that if they were to make an early decision now, they would be more likely to make a decision based upon how much money the candidates had, because the perception is how much money you have will determine how well you can do. And the fact that they did not pick, as you referred to them and others, as that either of the front runners is an indication that of three things. One, there's a lot of good labor candidates in the field. And two, they're worried about electability, too. And they do not want to. I'm not putting words in their mouth. I don't know why they made their decision. But my guess is a lot of those folks had to ask the question, if we endorse A, B, or C, can we sell them in our union hall? And I think they concluded it was too early to make that judgment.
Well, we regularly talk about campaign finance reform. And I suspect after this campaign, we will bring that up again. Is there any way to clean up that mess?
There is. Public financing. I introduced the first major public financing bill in 1974 with a guy who used to be in the Senate, Dick Clark, who runs the Aspen Institute now. It is the only way. Emphasize the only way to make sure that average people have the same influence of people with money. And money is, it's obscene, the idea you need $100 million, if that's true, to run for the presidency of the United States.
My guest is Joe Biden. He's written a book called Promises to Keep on Life and Politics. It's published by Random House. Some of the candidates who aren't given much of a chance, like Dennis Kucinich, Ron Paul, and Sam Brownback, run to keep issues they consider really important in the discussion. But aren't you running as a member of the Democratic establishment?
Well, I don't think so, because if you look, I've been around a while, but I have been a bit of a contrarian. I was asked in the debate, which I might add only 1 million people out of 300 million people in America watched, so talk about whether people are focused yet on this issue. and I was asked an honest question about all this problem with bridges and infrastructure. Senator, you've been there. Aren't you part of the problem? And I pointed out that as far back as 1992, I introduced a $20 billion infrastructure bill. I've been trying to get a $900 million expenditure to make sure your tunnels, the six underneath this city, which have more people at 5 o'clock today in aluminum tubes than in 25 747s renovated. There's no escape. There's no lighting. There's no ventilation. And so I have been the guy who has been, banging at the door constantly. I have not been part of the establishment's view on taxes, the establishment's view on foreign policy, the establishment's view on infrastructure, et cetera.
President Bush just came out today against a proposed 5-cent tax on gasoline to raise funds for bridge repair and upkeep.
I'd raise funds for bridge repair by eliminating the tax cut for the top 1%. They don't need it. It's $85 billion a year. For $85 billion a year, we can repair a whole lot of the bridges.
Now, what are you going to do to calm down some of the Democratic constituency who are really upset about a number of votes in Congress? I know you did vote for to go into Iraq or give the president the powers initially, but very quickly became a critic. But Democratic voters are upset that congressional Democrats backed down on the war spending bill, a recent one, and now angered that they've joined Republicans, at least too many of them, it is felt, to give new powers to the White House on the new Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Well, you know, I was one of the authors of that Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in the late 70s, one of four people who wrote that bill. I strongly opposed the recent vote that gave the president the ability for the next 6 months to continue to act as he has, basically.
Well, how does the president get so many Democrats to go along with him at a time when his poll numbers are so incredibly low?
I think in this case it was fear. You know, the president raised the ante by through the National Security Agency about all the, quote, chatter we're hearing about potential terrorist activities. And what they bluntly said was, you know, that if, in fact, you didn't give them this authority and there were another attack, that it would be argued that if you had the authority, there wouldn't have been the attack. I think that's garbage. I think that's malarkey. But the fact of the matter is, enough Democrats crossed over and gave them that authority. I think it was absolutely wrong. And I don't blame Democrats for being angry.
You voted for the final resolution to support the war in Iraq, and then after the war you argued repeatedly for more soldiers, but now you don't support the current approach. You're also against withdrawal, so you have a third way?
Yeah, I do have a third way. I am for withdrawal. The very thing we spoke to, by the way, that everybody talks about voting on is the Biden-Levin Amendment, which says that immediately begin to draw down combat troops. Get them all out but a small contingent by March of 08, get them out of the Civil War, and get a political solution that rests upon a federal system. There's never been a time in history when there's been a self-sustaining cycle of sectarian violence in a country that it's ended remotely well without separating the parties in a federal system.
Well, we talk about a federal system. At the same time, we talk about creating a strong central government in
we
Iraq.
Can't.
How can we do the both?
We can't. I'm opposed to a strong central government in Iraq. I've been opposed to it since before the president went in. It is the central fallacy my Democratic colleagues can cling to, as well as the president. It is not possible in your lifetime or mine to have a strong central government in Iraq accepted by the Iraqi people.
So a federal system would mean, in effect, a partition?
No, it would be just that, a federal system. It would be a limited central government, control of the army, the borders, and the distribution of the wealth. It would give local control, just as we did in Bosnia in the Dayton Accords. We separated the parties within the defined boundaries of a country with limited authority to the central government, with significant authority to the regions. That's exactly what it would do. It's worked in Kosovo. In Bosnia, and it will work in the only thing that will work in Iraq.
So why are so many people opposed to it, including all of the Iraqi politicians?
Well, that's not true. Not all Iraqi. The present.
Well, the Kurds
leadership
would like to have something. No. Well, they'd like to have Kurdish independence.
No, yeah, but they finally figured out if they have independence, the Turks are going to invade them. There'll be a war. So that's why they support what I'm proposing. That's why you have a number of the leaders in the Iraqi government and in the Iraqi tribal leadership supporting. That's why you have a vast majority of the intellectuals in this country now supporting that position.
So this
that's
is based on the Dayton Accords?
It's based on, similar to the Dayton Accords, it's based on the notion of a federal system. The Iraqi Constitution says in Article 1, we are a decentralized federal system. It says in Articles 1, 15, 16, 17, and 18, if you want to become a region under our Constitution, this is how you vote. And so it just calls for the implementation of their Constitution.
Do you think that this plan only has a chance if you're elected president?
No, it has a chance whoever were president if they're willing to give it a chance. But you cannot continue to cling to the notion that you're going to have a strong, central, unified government in Baghdad to be able to control the country. And that's what the president continues to cling to. It will. There is no trust of the government. There's no trust within the government, and there's no capacity from the central government to deliver the services necessary.
So what happens, Joe, if, and I know this is almost impossible to imagine, if you don't win the Democratic nomination and
now you're being
the
a wise
president.
Guy. Now, up to now, you're being wise. Everybody likes a guy, but nobody likes a wise guy. But go ahead, wise guy.
Now, what happens then? You're going to stay in the Senate?
I'm chairman of the. Assuming I run again and am reelected, I'd be chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee and begin to continue to try to have an influence on the administration.
Now, you're not going to go to the forum tonight. Do these forums and debates really make a
which forum is tonight?
The LGBT forum.
I did. There must be. Oh, I know why I'm not going to forum, because
yeah,
I committed to
problem.
Do this this book tour. I'm
yes.
trying to remember. There's so many.
Well,
forums.
we have only 15 seconds left, right. But I guess they are not the ultimate deciders. Only the president is. Joe Biden promises to keep. It's published by Random House.
Thank you,
and I want to thank you so much for being.
And I'm going to be your president, old buddy.
On tomorrow's show, Norman Perlstein, former editor-in-chief of Time magazine, looks back at the firestorm of criticism that erupted after he turned over Matt Cooper's notes on confidential sources and the Valerie Plame scandal. Then, a new documentary called Crossing the Line about an American-born soldier who defected to North Korea. Plus, Julie Delpy tells us about writing, directing, and producing and starring in a new movie called 2 Days in Paris. And Please Explain is all about hair. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Sarah English and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Rory Bernstein, Sophie Rand, and Jennifer Keeney-Sendro. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. I'll see you tomorrow.